and welcome to Talking Therapies, a podcast made together with Psychologies Magazine and the UK Council for Psychotherapy, or UKCP for short. I'm Susie Walker, and I'm the Editor-in-Chief of Psychologies. Each month on Talking Therapies, we will be talking to a UKCP therapist about a range of topics. In this episode, we will be discussing anxiety and how it can impact a person's life.
But it is vital to say that, tragically, the majority of people suffering from profound anxiety never seek help at all, and they suffer in silence. So when I'm asked what is the most common treatment administered for anxiety in the United Kingdom today, people expect you to answer, well, drugs or talking therapy. But in fact, the most common treatment for anxiety is no treatment at all, complete and utter neglect.
That was psychotherapist Professor Brett Carr. Brett has worked in mental health field for more than 35 years. He is a senior fellow at the Tavistock Institute of Medical Psychology, as well as a senior clinical research fellow in psychotherapy and mental health at the Centre for Child Mental Health. Brett has also published 12 books, lectured at clinical and academic institutions, as well as cultural organisations, and is a former resident psychotherapist of the BBC. Shortly, Brett will be talking to Sarah Niblock, the CEO of the UKCP, to discuss what causes anxiety. But first, here are some comments about anxiety from people we spoke to on the street.
Yeah, I've definitely experienced anxiety. I've worried about most things. I would say the thing I've probably worried about the most is my health. But the beauty about anxious people is that as soon as they stop worrying about one thing, they're very good at finding another thing to worry about instead.
One person might react to something completely differently. They might just keep thinking about that and let themselves drown in that emotion or how they're feeling. And someone else might just kind of deal with it, say, okay, that's cool, move on, and think about it later.
I'm not sure if women suffer more from it. It could also be that men don't actually express it. So it could be the same amount.
Yeah, I think there is, broadly speaking, still a bit of a taboo around talking about anxiety. Although, unlike other mental health conditions, sometimes people talk about their anxieties in quite a conversational way, which perhaps covers up the fact that it's something that's causing them a lot of distress.
Anxiety can affect anyone, no matter what their age or background. According to the Mental Health Foundation, in 2013, there were 8.2 million cases of anxiety in the UK. And in England, women are twice as likely to suffer with anxiety than men. Untreated anxiety can affect employment, income, and stability of relationships in adult life. So let's find out more about anxiety.
Brett, I think this is a topic that's going to chime with anyone listening. I think we've probably all had some experience of this. What are the symptoms of anxiety? We're used to having flutters in the stomach and moments where we're feeling quite sort of anxious, but what is anxiety? How do we know if we're feeling anxious as opposed to just having something that's a bit of mild nerves?
Anxiety is a universal human experience. Having worked in the mental health profession for over 40 years now, I have never met a single person who does not have the capability to struggle with anxiety. We all have the capacity to experience stress, but when stress becomes too unbearable, too painful, too unmanageable, then we would refer to that as anxiety. Now, the best description that I have ever heard of anxiety had been shared with me by a patient who suffered very severely from anxiety. And this person said, imagine having a washing machine in your head going round and round and round, and then somebody plugs your fingers into an electric socket. That is anxiety. And I think that that description is hugely poetic, very heartbreaking, but I think it's actually a brilliant literary encapsulation of what the anxious person is experiencing. In more formal technical language, we would describe anxiety symptoms. They're a cluster of symptoms which would contribute to the formal psychopathological diagnosis of anxiety. And these would include, for example, tremendous restlessness, irritability, difficulties concentrating. There would be many somatic complaints, so people in high states of anxiety often feel dizzy or lightheaded. They may suffer from migraines or nausea or have cramps in their tummy or feel their heart beating very, very fast indeed. It really is almost as though somebody has plugged your body into an electric socket. You become very, very hypervigilant. And the ordinary stresses and strains of everyday life become very, very persistent. You know, if you had to go on stage to give a performance of Hamlet or Lady Macbeth in a theatre, probably in the 2 or 3 minutes before you went on, you would feel a sense of stress. You'd think, oh my goodness, will I remember my lines? Have I got my costume on in the right way? But then once you're into it, you'd be absolutely fine because you wouldn't be doing that unless you were a consummate professional. That's stress. That's just the ordinary stress and burden of everyday life. But if you felt that every moment of every day of your life was rather like waiting in the wings, about to go on stage without knowing your lines at all, that is daily anxiety. And that cripples people and causes immense personal distress, deep unhappiness, and makes life look very ugly and feel very ugly.
Mm-hmm. And is there a single cause of anxiety? I mean, you've described a situation that does seem, you know, all-consuming 24/7. Is there a typical cause for that, or could it be a multitude of things?
If you ever want to stimulate a series of fights among mental health professionals, ask a group what causes anxiety, and no two psychotherapists or counsellors or psychologists or psychiatrists would have quite the same answer. Mm. There's a range of theories as to the causation of anxiety. There are some who would adopt a much more biomedical approach, and there is a small amount of evidence which suggests that a certain gene might predispose someone towards anxiety or make them more vulnerable. Some have researched and written about particular areas of the brain, such as the amygdala, which may play a role, as well as the neurochemistry of the brain, for example, distorted levels of neurotransmitters such as serotonin or norepinephrine, for example, might play a role. But speaking from my own extensive clinical practice, and I think the majority of my colleagues, most of us would agree that the predominant cause, whether there is a biological vulnerability or biological Achilles heel, I think most practicing mental health professionals would agree that anxiety is caused by external stressors and external traumata for which the person has not received any help at all over a sustained period of time. So we do know from very extensive longitudinal research following individuals over a long period of time, that if you have been victimized in childhood by either physical abuse, repeated physical abuse, or repeated sexual abuse, you will be much more likely to suffer from a generalized anxiety disorder as an adult than if you had a safe experience with your body. If you had been bullied persistently in childhood, once again, you are more likely to experience formal symptoms of anxiety in later life than someone who hasn't been bullied. So it is these external traumata. We know, for example, that in addition to just the ordinary kinds of abuse and torment that can happen in traditional British families, we know that in situations of outrageous stress, for example, war zones, now the letters PTSD, which were once used only by professionals, now virtually every educated man, woman, and child child knows that PTSD stands for traumatic stress disorder, and the huge core of that is the anxiety that comes from having had to watch people being blown up in war zones. In 2007, a very, very intelligent group of psychiatric researchers in Germany, a team headed by Dr. Udo Reulbach, published an important study. They followed up a very, very large percentage of people who had been inmates in the Nazi concentration camps during the Second World War. And approximately 73.5% of the survivors whom Dr. Reulbach and his colleagues interviewed met the formal diagnostic criteria for severe anxiety disorder. Mm. Now, there we have a direct connection between Nazi concentration camps and this very, very powerful psychological syndrome that really spoils people's lives.
And I think that a lot of listeners to this would take, obviously not all of us are confronted with situations of abject horror that you've described, but I think that there is a tendency, an automatic tendency, to think there's something wrong with us, that somehow we are not strong enough to deal with life's stresses, and that maybe there's just something fundamentally wrong with our makeup and our chemistry. Mm. But what you've done is actually show there's much peer-reviewed evidence that actually it's stuff that happens to us. And that we need to find through adequate, highly qualified support, perhaps the mechanisms for addressing that. I think for me, the question is, well, we do face everyday stresses now. I mean, I just think back to my journey into work this morning and prod and poked and squashed into trains. Then there's always challenging meetings, there's family difficulties. What's the difference between stress and anxiety? Where, how do we know that things have got bad and that we're suffering from something serious?
It is a very, very good question. What is the difference between stress and anxiety? I think the primary differentiation between these two categories is the length of endurance. If you said to somebody, okay, right now, jump up on that table and do a brilliant tap dance better than Fred Astaire, the person would go into a state of great stress. But if you then said, okay, well, sorry, I shouldn't have really put you on the spot. You don't have to do a tap dance for us immediately, or you don't have to give us your brilliant PowerPoint presentation with only 5 minutes preparation, then the healthy person would just breathe a sigh of relief and would relax. But the person in a state of anxiety has, for the last 6 months or more, one needs to demonstrate these symptoms for a period of a minimum of 6 months before you can receive an official psychiatric diagnosis of a generalized anxiety disorder. These people feel that they are on watch the entire time and that there is no respite. So there is a very profound phenomenological difference between just the pressures and stresses of everyday life, which we all have to navigate, and then feeling that we're constantly on display, we're constantly on the back foot, we're going to be fired, we are full of self-loathing and self-pity. Whereas I think a competent, healthy, resilient, stressed person would say, okay, I am stressed because I have agreed to do 17 PowerPoints by end of business, but I have done PowerPoints before, and I know that if I just put my mobile phone away and stop texting my friends, I can get it done. That's a healthy person who's stressed. That's not necessarily an anxious person. The anxious person would say, oh my God, I've got 7 years in which to do this PowerPoint presentation, but I am worthless and I can't concentrate. That is the sign of a person really experiencing a very profound anxiety disorder. Mm-hmm. And my hope would be that if somebody is in that state, that they would reach out either to their doctor, to their primary care physician, their general practitioner, to a qualified mental health professional, a psychotherapist or a related mental health colleague, or indeed to a good friend. One does not always need to be helped by a senior professional, sometimes a dear family member or a dear friend can be a wonderful, wonderful source of support. But it is vital to say that, tragically, the majority of people suffering from profound anxiety never seek help at all, and they suffer in silence. So when I'm asked what is the most common treatment administered for anxiety in the United Kingdom today, people expect you to answer, well, drugs or talking therapy. But in fact, the most common treatment for anxiety is no treatment at all, complete and utter neglect. So I think if this podcast interview accomplishes nothing else, I hope that people will take up the message and hear our plea and say that actually, if you are suffering, if your life feels absolutely ravaged by these chronic stresses, which we would refer to as anxiety, please do reach out. There's nothing to be ashamed about. Every human being can be anxious, has been anxious, and will be anxious again. It's part of being human. I remember one of my old teachers years ago said, the moment you are a human being, you are subject to love and you are subject to loss. You cannot be a human being without falling in love and without being disappointed in love, whether it's between a parent and a child, two adults, or when you become a parent yourself or with colleagues. So just by virtue of the fact that we have to navigate a world populated with other people who have vulnerabilities, it means we all run into trouble. So if you have an anxiety disorder, there's nothing to be ashamed about. Zillions of people do, and one should really reach out, because actually it is a very treatable, very helpable condition.
And I want to get onto that with you in terms of how that help can be achieved, but also what that might look like. But you're talking there about the scale of this, and I understand that women are twice as likely to suffer with anxiety than men. Why do you think that is?
I think that is a really, really profound and provocative question. And you're absolutely right. The research evidence does reveal that women are almost twice as likely to be diagnosed with a generalized anxiety disorder than male counterparts. And it raises huge questions. Are women less resilient than men? I'm not sure that that is the case. I think many men would say women are far more resilient. I think that being a woman presents enormous challenges, because although men have the responsibility of looking after families, men do not have the responsibility of carrying babies inside their bellies and often being the primary caregiver. And that is both a great potential pleasure for so many women, but also an enormous burden. Women are carrying centuries, millennia, I suppose, of denigration and hatred in male-dominated societies. I don't think that helps. But I would be very interested if we could review that data in 100 years' time, because whether women are really almost twice as anxious than men, or actually, as I secretly suspect, whether women are better and more able to reveal their vulnerabilities and share their vulnerabilities and talk about their vulnerabilities, that might well be the explanation. Mm-hmm. I don't have a sense from the daily psychological work that I facilitate in my consulting room that women are more ill as a rule than men. I've worked with some outstanding, robust, creative, phenomenal, wonderful women and men who have those characteristics. But I do think that on average, women feel a greater sense of authorization to reveal that vulnerability, and they don't wake up having to pretend to be Hercules.
That's matched with another podcast we've done, which looked at specifically at men and encouraging men to talk about their own anxieties. And some of the feedback there was that actually there are some even just professional discourses or environments that prevent men from being able to speak, and sometimes the world of work's just not set up very well for these things. I'm very interested, though, going back to your point about helping. I think to help people understand that actually this has become, they are in a position now where really they do need to seek help. What kind of impacts can anxiety have if left unaddressed? How does it manifest itself in someone's everyday life?
I think that the consequences of neglecting anxiety can often be severe. Some people do seem to have found a way to manage it, but in my experience, at least the people with whom I work, who leave their anxiety untreated, unattended to, they often describe their lives as completely lacking in color. Several patients have said to me over the years, being anxious, it's rather like somebody has just turned the volume down on your stereo or turned the volume down on your television, and you can't really hear what's going on in the rest of the world. So I think when you are crippled by anxiety, it diminishes you. It gives you a very psychologically anorexic state of mind where you're really starving and not able to feel sufficiently comfortable in your mind, sufficiently comfortable in your body to sit down at the banquet of life, if you like. Mm. So I think the consequences can be quite severe, and not only the psychological consequences, but also the physical consequences. We do have a growing body of evidence from psychosomaticians and physicians who work on psychological medicine that people in states of anxiety are much more likely to suffer from cardiac disease, for example. So the potential physical consequences are enormous. Mm. The only physical benefit that I have come across in the research literature, and this is a very, very interesting finding, is that people who are highly anxious are less likely to die in accidents, such as bike riding or mountain climbing or something potentially dangerous,
yeah.
Which is good that they're not putting themselves in those potentially endangering positions. Mm. But the reason they don't put themselves in those endangering positions is that they're frightened to put themselves often in any position. Mm. So not only will they not go mountain climbing, but in severe cases, they won't go to the shop to buy a pint of milk. They won't go to a friend's dinner party because they have a social anxiety or social phobia and are petrified of having to sit next to somebody and think, oh, well, I have nothing to say to this person. So I think we know from other bodies of literature that social isolation is very, very deadly for people. We know that actually you lead a slightly shorter lifespan if you are socially isolated than if you are plugged into rich, full networks, whether they are familial networks, social networks, or occupational networks. So the physical consequences of bearing untreated anxiety alone can be devastating.
It's quite remarkable to hear the extent to which anxiety can affect people in everyday life and those relationships around them. It's hard to imagine where how a psychotherapeutic relationship could even begin to address such a profound experience in somebody's life. Could you tell us a little bit more about what somebody might expect if they were to consider therapy to address this?
Psychotherapy, as you well know, and as many of our listeners may well know, is an enormous, broad, overarching term to describe a multitude of different psychological therapies. And many of our colleagues in psychotherapy specialize in quite time-limited, short-term interventions, particularly those who work in our overstretched but often wonderful National Health Service. It may be that your GP will recommend you to the local department of psychology or psychotherapy, and you might be given 3 sessions with a therapist or 6 sessions with a therapist, which is great. It's 3 sessions or 6 sessions more than you would have had otherwise. But I must say, as somebody who's been doing this work for a very, very long time, I don't think that a very short, sharp shock is always particularly helpful for a lifelong, deeply characterologically entrenched anxiety. Most of the people who come to see me for what is called open-ended psychotherapy need to come for at least a year, sometimes 2 years. A lot of my colleagues are reluctant to actually verbalize numbers because we don't want to scare people off. But if you, let's say you weighed, you know, 10,000 pounds, you were overweight, and you went to a personal trainer at your local gym, and the trainer said, "Ah, don't worry, you weigh 10,000 pounds, we'll have you in the Olympics in just, you know, 3 weeks of training sessions," you would not believe that person. If you weigh 10,000 pounds and you want to participate in the Olympics, you need to train and work out and exercise and eat well and look after yourself every single day for many months. And I often refer to psychotherapy as the gym for the mind. If you want psychotherapy to really help you, you've got to go regularly, and you've got to go regularly over a period of time. There's no quick fix for a deep-seated anxiety disorder. There's no short, sharp shock. One must attend on a regular basis, and I think most of the people that I've worked with who've really made profound strides, I would say profound strides, have come once a week as a minimum over a period of 1 to 2 years. And after that investment of time and hard work, really trying to talk through and get to the roots of the anxiety, they make often huge strides, tremendous progress. So I do want people to know that this is highly, highly treatable, but it's not immediately treatable and it's not magically treatable.
But I love your comparison with personal training, because I see psychotherapy as something that once you're experiencing that, once perhaps you've had a cycle of psychotherapy, it is, in a sense, it isn't something you do because you're too far gone. I think some people have this impression that psychotherapy is very, very serious and there must be something wrong with you to need that. But I think what you're explaining is that actually it can help prevent disorders, for want of a better term. It can actually prevent people's experiences of anxiety as well, and certainly halt them at a point where you can prevent them from worsening and becoming as serious as you have described, which I think is hugely heartening. And I just wish that people would see it as part of the way that people look after themselves in the way that we look after our bodies.
Very nicely put.
Inevitably, there are going to be, I would have thought, many listeners who are currently experiencing this for themselves, or may have perhaps family members, loved ones, colleagues who may be experiencing anxiety. And I just wondered if you had a few final words of advice to them as to what the next steps might be.
Many people who visit their medical doctors will be given a prescription for medication immediately. Generally, some sort of anti-anxiety agent or even antidepressants, and in severe cases, often beta blockers. And there are people who claim that these medications have been helpful to them. I think it's important to know that many, many patients tell us that they've been on these tablets for an awfully long time and they feel that it hasn't made much difference. It may be that my own sample is somewhat skewed, because most of the patients who have come to me with severe anxiety have been on medication of one sort or another, often for decades, and feel that they've got nowhere. If you have a good relationship with your GP and you feel that you have a sympathetic relationship with your GP, for heaven's sake, do ask the GP, well, what are the range of options that are open to me? You may not want to be put on tablets straight away. Have a dialogue with your physician. The physician may feel that there's a very good reason why that may need to be the case. Sometimes beta blockers are given to patients with immensely high blood pressure, and it may be that that is a symptom of certain types of anxiety that might benefit from a pharmacological intervention. But to be referred to a really skilled, really experienced, properly registered psychotherapist is, in my experience, a pretty good starting place, because the psychotherapist has both the interest, the training, and also the responsibility to try to get to the roots of the problem. So if you were abused in childhood, you and your psychotherapist would have an opportunity to talk about that abuse, to talk about the angry feelings you've been carrying towards your abuser for all this time, to talk about the feelings of shame that you have, to talk about your guilt that perhaps there was something you think you could have done to have prevented it. And once those horrible feelings are put into words, they do become, in my experience, less toxic. The talking cure, as Sigmund Freud described it back in the 1890s, is terribly relieving. Freud wrote about the way in which putting one's deepest, darkest secrets, one's most horrible internal feelings into words, brings a tremendous sense of catharsis. The number of patients who've said to me over the years, "Gosh, Brett, I'm so glad I just told you what I told you. I'd never told that to another living person before. You're the first person I've told, and I feel as though a huge weight has been taken off my shoulders." One of my patients, upon revealing having been sexually abused, said, "Wow, this talking stuff, it's like mouthwash for the mind." And I think that is a very, very powerful description of what can happen when you do find a sympathetic, highly trained, highly experienced, qualified psychotherapist with whom you can have these deeply private, deeply confidential, very intimate conversations which are focused entirely on you as the client or the patient. So members of the public have a lot of options. Medication is certainly an option. Consultation with your GP is certainly an option, but so is the pursuit of talking therapies. And for those who are too frightened to consult a professional, there are things that we can do in our own private life. We can try to attach ourselves to good friends and have a little coterie of people who can be our go-to confessors. We know from the work of the brilliantly named American psychologist Professor James Pennebaker that people who spend a mere 15 minutes per day keeping a personal diary and just putting into words their most private, unsettling feelings do feel better after several months of doing this. So keeping a diary can be very helpful. I think it's not as powerful and curative as the interactional relationship that unfolds in psychotherapy, which is very, very powerful indeed. But I think something like keeping a diary or practicing mindful meditation can be at least a good step on the ladder to try to do something. But what I would urge people is not to feel that they are required to abandon themselves and wallow in a state of psychological neglect.
Brett, I can't thank you enough for what is such a hopeful, positive, I think, a reassuring message to anybody and everybody who's listening to this. I think there's a step that we can all take today to begin to alleviate what is a very, very common condition afflicting so many of us. Thank you for bringing your expertise to the fore. Really,
thank you so much for your kind invitation, and I hope that a conversation of this kind will be genuinely helpful to people.
Thank you.
That was psychotherapist Professor Brett Carr speaking to Sarah Niblock, the CEO of the UK Council for Psychotherapy. If, after listening to that, you feel you could benefit from talking time with a psychotherapist, then go to the Find a Therapist section of the UKCP website and have a look through. The website address is www.psychotherapy.org.uk and look for the Find a Therapist tab. We're also featuring the subject of anxiety in Psychologies this month, and you can find us online at www.psychologies.co.uk. We'll be doing a podcast each month for the next year with some of the UKCP psychotherapists. And remember to like and subscribe to our channel to hear it first, and it helps others to find us too. So join us again next month. Till then, thank you for listening and take good care of yourselves.